Well, with that, Representative Abrams and President Brunix. President Brunix, welcome to the committee. We'd appreciate it if you would just run through the bill, give us some background on the stadium proposal, talk about the details of this one. If you feel so inclined, there may be questions. Also, the last one and why you made the change to what we have today. And thank you for coming, President Brunix.
Good, thank you. It's great to be here. I'm going to turn it to Representative Abrams first. Do you want to introduce the bill?
Yeah, very briefly, Mr. Chairman. Yes, there has been a change in the bill in the last couple of weeks, but there's a real question as to how major a change it is. The original proposal that came before you called for 40% of the funding for the new on-campus stadium for the Minnesota Gophers to be paid for by the state through a $7.4 million annual appropriation to until the bonds were defeased, and 60% to be raised from non-state sources. And President Brunix could talk a little bit about at least what the current plan is as to the non-state sources. The change that has been made in House File 263 in the last couple of weeks increases the share that the state will pay from $7.4 million per year to $9.4 million per year. However, there is land which the University of Minnesota acquired from the federal government for $1 in 1947 that is environmentally sensitive and would provide recreational opportunities that is currently underutilized. President Brunings will go over in detail the current uses of the land and what, in fact, the benefit to the state would be for the new land. In answer to a couple of the questions that Representative Knobloch has talked to me about privately, yes, the land would not be transferred until the final payment were made, but that's no different than a contract for deed, members. We're all familiar with contracts for deed that if you don't make the payment, you basically lose what you paid, and I don't anticipate that to occur here. And President Brunings will discuss the current uses that the university makes of the land, and they will be able to make the same uses. No different from a covenant that runs with the land. And in no way would the university's use of the property be decreased from its current use, but there would be additional public access. With that, I think that it may be beneficial and time efficient for President Brunings to discuss the proposal in detail, and we are here to answer all members' questions.
President Brunix.
Chair Knobloch, members of the committee, it's great to be with you this afternoon, and I'll try to make my remarks very brief so that we can get to your questions, and I'll try to take a little time to walk through the handout you have before you. This proposal is prompted by the near certainty that the Metronome will be abandoned by 2011. Clearly, I think the consensus is, first of all, the leases run out by then, and the professional teams are most likely to be out of the Metrodome. As a single tenant of the Metrodome, this is a clearly untenable option for the University of Minnesota. I won't go into the great details behind my statement, but let me just simply say that it costs more than $7 million a year just to operate the Metrodome. There's 35 years of deferred maintenance sitting there at the Metrodome that would probably, arguably, cost another $3 to $4 million a year. And the proposal you have before you is a lot more cost-effective for supporting the needs of the University of Minnesota to continue to play Division I football, but it adds the considerable advantage of bringing the football program back to the campus as a center of campus life and as a center of the Minnesota community. We envision a 50-seat stadium, open-air stadium. 50,000. I'm not. Excuse me.
Well, I heard a clock.
I was just talking about the president's suite. But anyway, 50,000-seat open-air stadium. that would restore the game day traditions that we know and remember. We think this would be a considerable asset for the University of Minnesota, the students, alums, the high school students in Minnesota. The University of Minnesota Marching Band would have a home for the first time. It would be a place that would be used at least 100 times a year if the experience of other campuses is any guide at all. We've really done our homework, and I think this proposal is sound. And the original proposal that Representative Abrams talked about, I thought was sound on its own merits. I think what we're bringing forward adds significant public value to the conversation we've had about the Gopher Stadium. We were approached in the last few weeks by leaders in Dakota County and other parts of Minnesota with whom we have been working collaboratively for many years on the planning of what we call Umore Park, a parcel of land of about 7,700 acres, 10-mile square parcel of land in Dakota County. And the proposal was to identify a portion of that land that is environmentally sensitive, approximately 2,840 acres, and to work together to build a permanent nature reserve in that particular area and to protect it forever for widespread public use. And why is that really important? This is a piece of land, and what I would, I guess, encourage you to do is look at the last page of this handout. There's a diagram, and you can see what we're really talking about without all the glorious detail. But the green portion, this lower right-hand portion of the diagram, 10, 11, 12, 14, 13, is the land we're really talking about. It is environmentally sensitive. It includes one of the great trout streams in the trophy trout stream in Minnesota. It's a land of rolling hills with nature trails at the present time. It contains two endangered species recently identified by the Department of Natural Resources. It's a piece of property that has been subjected to numerous studies, environmental studies, special land use studies, and it has always been envisioned as a sensitive area of the property, one that is in need of long-term environmental protection. So we think this gives the state, the university, and the citizens of our community a rare opportunity to expand and build the kind of park and open space area that is very similar to what you see in the Hennepin Park systems and in other parts of Minnesota. So what are the advantages and benefits? First of all, it dedicates on a permanent basis in perpetuity this land, this green space, which is adjacent to and connected to other environmentally protected areas identified by DNR and projected for development by Dakota County. So it would create a very substantial regional entity. It would allow the university to maintain certain types of research and educational programs that I would regard, and I know DNR will regard, as completely compatible with the long-term purposes of this property. Research, for example, on the effects of erosion on water quality, ways to protect land in ways that that are important to the long-term preservation of species and the maintenance of biodiversity on the property. And it would permit this valued work that the university now does in collaboration with the Department of Natural Resources. It would also put the responsibility for the long-term public development and the support of public access where it, I think, properly belongs, and that is with the Department of Natural Resources. If you take just a few moments, I'd like to go start with the first page of this handout. I don't need to spend a lot of time. The first page simply shows you the siting of the stadium at the University of Minnesota campus. If you've been to Williams Arena and Mariucci Arena, you can see exactly where the stadium is located. This siting of the stadium preserves all the current parking that is now available on this site, approximately 2,500 cars. And it's located on the St. Paul Minneapolis Transit Way, which gives quick access to the St. Paul campus, and also it's positioned to connect to the West Bank, so there's very, very adequate parking in the area to accommodate what we're talking about. The stadium would be expandable to 80,000 seats if demand developed over the next several years, but we thought we would start at a more modest and affordable level. The next page gives you the financial assumptions. As Representative Abrams talked about it, if you look at the first column, it says original 60-40 partnership. I'm looking at this particular page. You can see what the original proposal was, with an annual contribution from the state of $7.4 million, and then close to $150 million worth of university responsibility that we had projected from student support. That student support number estimates about $50 per semester. There is a certain amount of revenue coming from incremental game day revenue, parking revenue, $13 million, and then we have a very, very tall order to raise about $83 million in private fundraising through private gifts, sponsorships, and other activities. We're making very good progress in this area, but there's still some gap to fill that we're quite confident we can fill given state support. You see in the second middle column the revised 50-50 proposal, which involves the transfer of the land, the 2,840 acres that I just mentioned. The state responsibility would move to $124 million, allowing the university or giving us the opportunity to lower the level of impact on our students to roughly $25 a semester. And I might add that we have spent about 3 years talking about this issue with our students, and they would receive for this modest contribution, contribution that students made in the early 1920s to build Memorial Stadium. They would receive preferential seating, discounted tickets, a number of other benefits that I think make this a very, very good deal for the students as well. And you can see the private fundraising goes up approximately $2 million. And in the far right column, you can see the dollar changes. We think this is obviously the right thing to do. I must tell you that it's, from my point of view, urgent to address this issue. It takes about 3 years to build a stadium. It takes time to develop the fundraising and support that we're projecting here. And I must tell you that I think if we don't get the vote this year, it's going to be extraordinarily difficult, if not impossible, to pull this off. Our students recently voted with only one dissenting vote out of about 40 to 45 people in attendance to support this proposal, having unanimous support from the Faculty Consultative Committee, the Empire Township people of the board has recently sent us a letter of support. We have a strong commitment from the University of Minnesota Alumni Association, including a $1 million gift for scholarships and a $1 million gift for the stadium. And it has extraordinary support from our fan base and friends of the university across the state. So let me stop here and take your questions and comments, and if we have time, I also have some people in the audience who could add further light to this proposal if needed.
Okay, I see a number of questions. Let me start with Representative Seifert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize, I came late. Mr. President, Representative Abrams, there's been some discussion in the media, and I've had some constituents ask about the naming rights issue, that there's another proposal. I don't believe it. I don't know if it's in the House or believe it's in the House, but what some of my constituents have asked is, I believe the old plan and new plan have over $20 million. What happens if, for some reason, this is put into a tax bill or another bill that would disallow naming rights to help pay? Who would make up for that? And I don't have an answer for this person if something like that were to happen. And is this a proposal that's in the House, or is it just the Senate?
Yes.
President Brunick.
Chair Knobloch, Representative Seifert, members of the committee. This proposal was discussed in, I guess it was it House Operations? No.
Capital Investment.
And a proposal was made to substitute roughly $2.5 million a year in state support to make up for the naming agreement we have with TCF Bank, and it was voted down. There is a proposal in the Senate to do something similar, although I don't know if any state money is attached to it. So what would happen is we would lose a $35 million commitment. In 25-year present value terms, it's worth about $21 million. That would add either to state responsibility or it would add to the obligation of private fundraising. And it reminds me of what Woody Hayes once said about the forward pass in football. He said three things can happen and two of them are bad. I think these are bad options for the state. It costs the state more money, which I think might operate to the detriment of the university's academic interests long term, a proposition that I would not find very comfortable. Or it adds to private fundraising, and I can tell you the fundraising that we have on the table is, in my judgment, doable, but if you increase it very much, it's going to make this a very, very difficult proposition. So I don't think it's a very good idea. We'll just have to see where it goes from here. I must tell you that we framed this proposal for the Minnesota legislature and the governor, the citizens of this state, to do everything possible to accomplish the task, but to minimize the long-term impact on the university's academic interests. And that's why we didn't come in with a two-thirds, one-third proposal, as you usually do with capital bonding. We said we wanted to roll up our sleeves, see if we could raise more private money, drive down the cost to the state, because we know you have finite resources, and we know that you have to make these very difficult decisions. To us, our academic mission is paramount, and we need to make sure that we that don't put that at risk. And so that's a long-winded sort of answer as to what the trade-offs are, Representative Seifert, but there is at least a proposal, I think, to do a similar thing in the House. I should also say that one of the proposals was to name it Memorial Stadium. We have met with all the veterans groups in Minnesota and formed a working committee. They have a strong letter of support in favor of the proposal you have in front of you. They are working with us to find an appropriate way to memorialize and recognize the extraordinary contributions our veterans have made to keeping freedom not only here but around the world.
Representative Abrams.
A further answer, Representative Seifert, is that there are a number of other facilities that intercollegiate athletics play in that are named after corporations. Probably the most famous one would be the Carrier Dome for the University of Syracuse that plays both their football games and their basketball games at. Secondly, you've got to think about the chilling effect it would have to the university's fundraising and other aspects. Now, Carlson School of Business is, of course, named after Kirk Carlson, and Carlson Companies is named after Kirk Carlson as well. But you can go up and down a long list of partnerships that the university has had, not only with individuals, but with corporations. For instance, the house in the current School of Business is the 3M Auditorium. There's the Honeywell Auditorium. If you go to Mondale Hall, which houses the law school, you will see Toyota Plaza. I don't know if Mr. Toyota is a graduate or if it's the Toyota Corporation.
I think that was given in honor of the Vice President for his service as Ambassador to Japan.
Okay. So, you know, you can go on and say, somehow cut this out by saying that, well, gee, this is so important, we shouldn't have any name attached other than a non-corporate name. But the incentives that the legislature has set up for both the university and for Minscu is to do private fundraising and to do some of these things. And when you have a large donor who's willing to step up with a $20 million net present value gift, together with a fairly successful and emulated program throughout academia for student banking, et cetera, I think it really would send a chilling signal if, in fact, this legislature did not allow the Board of Regents to make the determination as to how they're going to handle the naming of the facility.
Representative Klingsing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering, with regards to both pieces of land that are involved in this land swap that it's referred to as, if any environmental analysis has been done about the maybe potential pollution in the, on the lands, if there's any that you're aware of, and at what point an analysis might be done. And should an analysis come back that there needs to be some cleanup, whose responsibility that would need to be?
President Brunix.
Chairman Knobloch, Representative Klingsing. The shaded area in green was used to store some munitions during the World War II period, but to our knowledge contains very little pollution. The yellow portion to the north contains some land that requires more remediation, to be quite frank about it. The university has been working with the Army Corps of Engineers to address these issues. The agreement would require that we work to get that, get any such issues addressed by the federal government. Charles Muscat-Platt, who is the director of our long-range planning for this property, is here, and he can probably give you a much better explanation than I can. But the agreement would not require the university at its expense to do this. We would go and work to try to get it addressed by the federal government, and we're quite confident we can get that done.
Representative Cranky, to that point.
Very quick question. Were there, since I'm not very familiar with this piece of property and what all occurred on it, Mr. Chairman, President Brunix, were there munitions actually manufactured on this site?
President Brunix.
Chair Knobloch, Representative Cranky, I don't know if they actually, they did go into production, didn't they? This is Vice President Charles Muscat-Platt. He can answer more detailed way your question.
Vice President Muscat-Platt, welcome to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Chair Knobloch. Representative Cranky, I believe that the munitions were produced from about till early 1945 until the war ended. It operated for 9 months. At that moment in time, there were 800 buildings, largely in the northwest corner in the yellow area. And there was 12,000 people employed by the Department of the Army at the time. When they ceased operations, they cleaned up much of it and demolished the buildings, transferred the land to the university in 1947. There were some munitions stored in the green area in the northwest corner of the green zone. And like President Brunix said, that we are in discussions with the Army Corps of Engineers and the Department of the Army for cleanup, and they do retain the responsibility for any cleanup.
Representative Cranky.
Mr. Chairman, as someone who represented the former Twin City Army Ammunition Facility site for a number of years, just for everyone's edification, that's the largest Superfund cleanup site in the state of Minnesota. The work has been ongoing there for the last, I think it's at least 20 years. So the idea that there were munitions that were actually manufactured on this site, and if the Army operated that facility anyway or similar to the way they operated the facility in Arden Hills, you can be guaranteed that there are going to be necessary cleanup costs. And so to just merely say that these are the federal government's responsibilities and that's where we're going to leave it, I said I didn't realize, Mr. Chairman and members, that this actually said munitions manufactured on this site, I think raises some serious questions as to what the environmental hazards may be and the extent of cleanup that might be necessary before the land could be used for any number of activities. Again, the Arden Hills facility has been fenced off. I mean, it was decommissioned much later, obviously, after the Vietnam War. But and obviously, there was a significant more activity in the Arden Hills site. But just the fact that you say that munitions were manufactured there would leave one to have great concerns about what the environmental ramifications might be and what those cleanup costs could potentially be.
And Mr. Nockmuskapai.
Chair Knobloch, Representative Krinke. I believe that the vast majority of the activity was done in quadrant number 35 on your map in the yellow zone. We have maps of all the buildings and where things were stored, and the overwhelming amount of activity was done in section 35. There was a tiny bit of munition storage in and around the northwest part of the green zone of section 9 or 10, and it would only operate for 9 months. The plant came online in just 9 months before the World War II ended, so it didn't operate that much compared to really dozens and dozens of other munitions plants around the country. We don't have reason to believe that there is pollution. The question is, we need a more thorough evaluation, and that's the discussion that's underway with the Army Corps of Engineers and the Defense Department. And the counsel behind me would assure me and you that the Army is responsible for any cleanup that should be necessary.
Representative Frankie,
incidentally, there was no production in this land that we're talking about. There was no production.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it was at the Arden Hills facility, it was the leaching of the contaminants into the groundwater, which extended a plume of contamination in the groundwater for, I think, something close to, probably over 10 miles from the actual site. So just because you say that there was no production in the shaded green area wouldn't mean that there isn't groundwater contamination somewhere. Again, I'm not an environmental engineer nor an environmental expert to be claiming that I know what might be there and what might need to be cleaned up, but I think that if we're starting to talk about the state having involvement in this land, and we're talking about a $9.4 million a year transfer of dollars, I think we need to know a little bit more about what the potential environmental contamination is, what the estimated cleanup costs might be, and how they might impact the use of the land.
Chairman,
Representative Krinke, I want to remind members of the committee there's a classic stream that runs through here. It's called the Vermilion Watershed. It supports brown trout and the natural reproduction of brown trout. I'm no expert, and I'm not going to give you an opinion as to how much or if there is any pollution here, but I seriously doubt, in the absence of any serious production of munitions, that this is going to be a big problem. And if it is, if there's any problem whatsoever, this would be an issue that we would address with the federal government, and they would have to correct it.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Clancy and Krinke have asked some of the questions I was going to ask about the contamination. Unfortunately, I don't share your confidence in the federal government's cleanup. I mean, their history is miserable in cleaning munitions in other lands. And even now, you'll find writings in our just leading newspapers about some of the problems that of the federal government resisting taking responsibility. So for me, I just, what contaminants do you expect that might be there, either on the land, on the ground, or having gone into the groundwater, as Representative Krinke suggested could have happened?
I'd like to introduce Ken Larson, who is one of the lead attorneys in the Office of General Counsel at the University of Minnesota.
Mr. Larson, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Well, thank you. I'm pleased to be here. I'm going to give you kind of a longer, I don't know, answer, but I will give it to you. The southern part of the land that we're talking about transferring to the state of Minnesota, the 2,840 acres, was the subject of a deed in 1947 to the University of Minnesota. And as to this land, the Department of Defense, or I should say, made a decision and advised the university in writing that it was responsible for contamination on that property. And what's expected is that the federal government will do an environmental assessment in 2007, and then, as funds are available, will actually do the cleanup following that period of time. So far, there has been some environmental testing on the land, and there have been three areas identified as what are called areas of concern. In one area, there was found to be some increased levels of contamination. It was a settlement area. So just picture a swale. And picture it raining on the north part of the land and some water running down to the south part of the land. There's some environmental contamination from that. Other parts of the land have not been tested. The Army has said that they would not be surprised to find where the storage facilities were, that some canisters, for example, that contain smokeless gunpowder, that's what was manufactured there, may have broken open. But at the same time, there has been no test that's shown that that was the case, and as I say, the Army has made a determination of eligibility as to that 1947 parcel for federal funding for both the assessment and the cleanup.
Representative Guinness.
Mike, you said it was smokeless gunpowder, but my question was, what is that contaminant? I mean, what is the chemical contaminant that you would or would not be worried about?
Mr. Larson?
You seem not to be worried about.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilginius, members of the committee, I would be in over my head to talk about exactly what chemicals are there. I don't know. We've used outside counsel on this and outside environmental experts, but in fact it's the Army itself and the Army Corps of Engineers that has retained its experts to do the testing, and I can't speak for what they have found.
I think, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Guinness,
members, if we knew, we might have a sense of, I mean, folks know that some things go through the ground quickly, some things don't, and that might help us in answering Representative Krinke's question. So it seems that there's a lot more information available, and it would be useful for us to know about it. It doesn't preclude me from wanting to transfer the land, but it does seem to me that, in all fairness, everything should be in the sunshine, and we should know. And so that is whatever is out there, folks should understand. But I have now a couple of questions for Representative Abrams, if I could. We have talked about this as a shared responsibility between DNR and the ongoing. Do you have an estimate on what that is going to cost DNR to maintain this property for a year over the next 25 years? Or have we talked to DNR about the cost of that?
Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, that's a very good question. Representative McNamara and Representative Osmond and folks from Dakota County have done much more work in that area. Maybe President Brunix has been part of the conversations as to what it would cost DNR on an annual basis to run the land.
President Brunix.
Chair Knobloch. Representative Wagenius, I don't think we have an estimate of that, but it is not land that would require an intensive amount of management, but perhaps.
Yeah.
Representative Abrams.
The better answer, Representative Wagenius, is for the first 25 years, it is the university's responsibility. If there are any improvements that DNR wishes to make to the land, that would be their responsibility.
Representative Wagenius.
Then I hope, Representative Abrams, as you write this in, we make sure that we define what are improvements, because along that Vermilion River, I know there are banks that are falling in. Who's going to make sure that no more banks fall in? And one of the things that you have to watch there is if there's plenty of canopy for the trout streams, because you don't want them to get too hot, that's not good for trout. And there are issues like that, and the weeds down there are marvelous. And so we are going to have to manage.
Yes.
And I think we would need to, we should understand the management plan that the U is going to engage in over these next 25 years, so we don't get a weed patch, we don't inherit just a whole bunch of Greek fairy grass, which we can.
President Brunette?
Yes, Chair Knobloch, Representative Wagenius. It's in our mutual interest to manage this property in the most responsible way. We are restoring the property, preserving the property. Our people do research on these very issues. It's a place of education related to the impact of so many factors on the environment. So it's in our mutual interest in to do this well. And the commitment we have is that we are going to jointly develop the plan and jointly ensure that we protect the property and make it publicly accessible. So we don't have all those details worked out, but we have a deep commitment on the part of both public parties and also a commitment to come back and tell you what our progress is in getting this done, because you have an annual payment on the line, and if we don't do our stewardship and we don't live up to our responsibilities, I think you have more than a little influence on our behavior. But it's in our interest. We're a public university. One of the top priorities of the future of the University of Minnesota is around the issues of the environment. It will be one of our signature areas of research and education as far as the eye can see. And so I don't have any doubt making any problem making a pledge to this committee that this will be taken with the utmost seriousness by the university and its leadership. For the long term, we have a very serious vested interest in making sure this property is preserved, and I think that also applies to the Department of Natural Resources.
Okay, I've got quite a few people who have got questions. Can I about one last question, Representative Wagenius?
Thank you. I'm getting mixed messages here, not that you don't have a commitment, but it seems to me if this was in good shape right now, we wouldn't have to worry so much about it. But I am getting the idea that some of this isn't in such good shape. So, I mean, in terms of canopy, weeds, and that kind of thing. So I would want Representative Abrams to just note that as you're working on it.
Okay. Mr. Representative Abrams, of course I'll be concerned about it, but I do think that, at least from everything I have heard, this is a highly desirable open space that has been preserved for almost 60 years by the university and improved by the university and used by the university for research and for studies, etc. And nothing is going to change. And as President Brunig's pointed out, yes, it is an open and standing appropriation, but if the legislature decided not to make a payment, if they deleted it, the University of Minnesota is on the hook for the $9.4 million. They're the ones who are issuing it to the paper. So they are incented to make sure that this is a good outcome.
Representative Wagenius, the other thing I would say is that the DNR and the University of Minnesota are building this joint management strategy and plan as we go forward, and it will have to be mutually agreeable, and they too report and are accountable to the legislature. So there are many things I go to bed worrying about. I don't worry about whether these two entities will take the environmental preservation of this property seriously.
Okay, members, I have Representatives Carlson, Ruth, Holberg, Bradley, Sikora, Dempsey, Vandeveer, and Krinke. Representative Carlson.
Chairman, I have two questions. If you want to change focus, mine don't happen to be on the environment, but don't want to preempt others on that question. We heard this bill, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Brunix, a year ago in the Higher Ed Finance Committee, and it was passed out there. And my question centers on the TCF contribution. At that point in time, if my memory serves me correctly, we talked about $35 million from TCF
yes.
for naming rights. Since then, I've heard references to $20 million. And if you could explain what the difference there is, and then as part of your answer, how the $20 or $35 million plays into the 82.8 or the 84.5, I guess, under the new scenario.
Introduce Richard Fitzenreiter. I can answer this question, but he can answer it far better. He's our Chief Financial Officer, Vice President for Finance.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Mr. Chairman, members, the TCF naming agreement was an agreement that was $35 million. However, that money comes through in annual payments of roughly $1.4 million a year over the next 25 years. That is not timed the same as constructing the stadium within the next 3 years. The university will issue debt to the tune of $18.5 million plus their $2 million upfront cash. And so that $35 million in present value turns into $20.5 million that we actually apply towards the construction of the stadium.
So, Mr. Chairman, if you could run that last point by me with when you say when you actually apply it, so then what number is applied to the 84.5?
$20.5 million.
Is applied to that?
Yes.
Okay. Then, Mr. Chairman, I think that explains that. My next question, I've had a few people that have been somewhat critical of the stadium. Not many. So that's good news for you, I think. I'm talking constituents. But one question that has come up that I don't really have the answer to is that we're spending a lot of money for 5 or 6 games. Now, again, I'm turning the clock back a year, and I think there was references by the university or maybe by Representative Abrams about the other uses of the stadium. And if you know what those are now, and what I would quite frankly like to be able to send back to those few constituents that have raised that question would be a list of what the other uses are going to be, so that people will have a little better understanding that it's not just for the football games. And if you could either provide that with us, I'd like a general answer now, and then maybe if you could provide a handout or something that clarifies what those uses are going to be.
President Brunix.
Members of the committee, I'll just use an example. The Ohio State University has an outdoor football stadium. They use this stadium for 150-plus events every year. We would plan to use our stadium in a similar way. So obviously it would be the chief venue for home Gopher football games, but this stadium will also have artificial turf and be laid out in a soccer field format, so intramural sports will be played there at the University of Minnesota on the East Bank campus. It will be a place where we can host football as well as soccer tournaments, for high school and amateur sports. Representative Carlson, it will be used as a home for the university marching band. Half of this stadium will have meeting rooms and club rooms that can be used for career fairs. It's diagonally located across from the McNamara Alumni Center and provides some great synergism in that way. So we see a lot of activities that could be used for university-wide graduations that are not as feasible to, obviously not feasible to do today. Various concerts and other kinds of public events. So it'll be used quite extensively. And I'd be happy to provide a list of possible uses as a part of the public record.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, thank you. And then the other question I had, and then I'm done, is just a quick one, I think. When I look at this map on the back, there wasn't a key that went with it, and I'm not sure what the difference between yellow and green is on here. Is that a whole parcel? Is it the yellow and green that's a whole parcel? And if so, what does that code mean?
President Brunix.
Yeah, Chair Knobloch, Representative Carlson, we're talking about the transfer of the green section, the lower right-hand section. numbers 10, 11, 12, 13, and 14. And the land to the north is under very careful planning exercise right now. We have a long-range planning exercise that is being conducted by the University of Minnesota and Sasaki, world-renowned land use planning firm. And but that is not being considered as a part of this transfer. And this particular land is not as environmentally sensitive or is useful for environmental and open space public use.
Okay, so Mr.
It's also a place where a lot of agricultural research is now conducted.
So the 2,840 acres is the green.
Is the green.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Brittings, you've been very successful in your fundraising recently, but one of the concerns that's been brought to me is that with, now I know you're going to be aggressively fundraising for this as well, but if the funds are haven't been going to the stadium in the past, so is there a concern that if enough dollars weren't made, that it would affect other areas of the University of Minnesota?
President Brittings.
Chair Knobloch, Representative Ruth, I think this is a very good question, and it's one that we thought about long and hard in formulating this plan and developing a set of core values and principles to guide this effort. These principles actually went to the Board of Regents, and the first principle that we articulated had to do with preserving and protecting the academic mission of the University of Minnesota. I have made dozens and dozens of calls to interest people in this project, and I have never made a single call without talking about the academic mission of the University of Minnesota first, and without also trying to encourage people that I talk to make an academic commitment along with any kind of reflection of interest in the stadium. And what I find inspirational about the way we launched this, the very first gift given to this campaign came from the University of Minnesota Alumni Society. It was our association. It was a $1 million stadium gift combined with a $1 million scholarship gift. And I think we can continue to use this as a way to engage people in the academic needs of the university. If the dollar amount were to be raised substantially, for example, people say, well, the university is quite successful in raising dollars for its public mission. Couldn't you just raise much more money? And I, as a person who spends most of his life working and worrying about these issues, I can tell you I think we have this properly balanced. I think if we raise that bar much, it's going to make it very difficult to achieve, and I think at some point you're going to risk some harm to the academic mission. So I think it's very, very carefully balanced, and even the state request was thought about very, very long and hard because we didn't want to jeopardize our relationship with the legislature and the governor with respect to the long-term academic needs of the university as well. So I think this is, you know, I think our original proposal was sound. I think this modification of the proposal creates additional and I think very substantial public value and a long-term legacy that we can be proud of. But I think these are always difficult issues to juggle. With a stadium, you have much more opportunity to create a corporate sponsorships, you know, so that General Mills or some other firm can pay the university so much a year over the next 10 years and in return get some spots or some, you know, some radio television spots or some presence in the stadium. And those are typically sources of funding that do not go to the academic mission of the University of Minnesota. But even in those conversations, I've been struck by how interested people are in stretching a little bit and thinking about student scholarships, the music program at the University of Minnesota, and other areas of interest.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Abrams, I've watched you over the years, and you don't seem to be a big fan of finding in bills. And in looking at this bill on page 1, line 23, the purpose of this act is to provide a firm 50% level of funding. I'm concerned that if the price goes up, that could get us in trouble, and want to know the rationale for that, and would you rather not have that in the findings and rather be hard in as far as the amount of dollars?
Uh,
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Abrams.
You know, I'm not. I am not the greatest. I got to be careful given some other things that are going on, but I'm not the greatest proponent of legislative findings. I really believe that legislative history is on this tape, Representative Holberg, and on the statement on the floor. You know, Mr. Fitzenreiter will be able to show you the language that on page 3.17. It says, except to the extent of the annual appropriation described in this section, the state is not required to pay any part of the cost of designing or constructing the stadium. If it would make you feel a little more comfortable, Representative Holberg, I don't see any personally, I take out the findings, but I'm kind of their attorney on this, or representative on this. But if you want to have an amendment tomorrow to take out the last sentence on page 1, I really have no problem with that.
Mr. Fitzenreiter? I'm sorry, I thought you had a comment. Okay, Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair and Representative Abrams, I too would be a lot happier if the whole findings section was gone. I think it's just a waste of paper. And as I've said many times, I came here when there were 15 statute books, and the day that there's 16, I'm out of here. So,
putting us on the incentive program, Representative Holberg.
And then, can you tell me, just make this clear, will there be more public use of this property in the intervening time, and how will that be managed, or do we as the state only get to expand the public use after the final payments made, or how does this work?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's envisioned that the university, working with DNR, managing the increased public activity, that there would be increased public activity of the land. One thing that President Brunings has not brought up is that this land has been subject to intense internal planning by the University of Minnesota. It has been subject to numerous meetings, not only with the Department of Natural Resources, but with Dakota County, with the neighboring townships, etc. And it's almost the confluence that this bill was coming forward right at a point in which there were decisions to be made regarding the future of this property. So this is not a new issue to Dakota County. This is not a new issue to the surrounding townships. This is not a new issue to the environmental groups, the sportsman groups, and to the Department of Natural Resources. They've been working to try to find a solution to better utilize this land for public purposes. And it's not, you know, the university has a lot of things good, but one thing that's not in their mission statement is to basically run a public access park, and that's basically what's necessary here.
And Mr. Chair, can you then, Representative Abrams, tell me where in your bill that is made clear?
That would be in line 2.23, which is other permitted uses, and land protection and transfer would also make it clear. But if Mr. Fitzenreiter, did I hit both sections? That's how I would read it. It Representative Holberg, it isn't a lot, but those... And there'll be a clarifying amendment to deal with that issue tomorrow, Representative Holberg.
I'll wait to see that amendment. Thank you, Representative Abrams.
You know, I guess to this point, though, if I can, Representative Abrams, one thing I'm confused about is what, I guess for starters, if the state is buying this land and I see the permitted university uses, I guess what, if anything, will the university not be able to do after the state buys the land or starts to make payments on the land? I mean, are we actually buying the land? I mean, we're buying the land in the sense that title is changing, but usually when you buy something from someone, you have possession and they don't. And the university still has some significant rights here that they have now.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll give a short answer and let the General Counsel's Office give a longer answer. Yes, the university would continue its current uses, but the property itself is greatly underutilized. And that's what the university is giving up, if you will, is the other uses of the property that they currently aren't making. And, if you will, it's probably the greater use of the land for other purposes of an underutilized parcel. But
Mr. Larson.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Abrams is correct. The first thing we would be doing, whether it's by declaration or by agreement, is making clear that we would not use that land for residential, commercial, or industrial purposes. So that would go off the table immediately. The second thing, this contemplates that we would immediately enter into negotiations with the Department of Natural Resources for the management of the land. And so while, for example, the university would have the continued right to use the land for its research mission, for example, we would expect that in an agreement with the Department of Natural Resources that we would agree that that does not contemplate the construction of, for example, a laboratory building, but instead it's agricultural research of the sort that we have been conducting on that land and the adjacent land for the last 50 years.
Mr. Larson, is there anything the university is doing with the land right now that it would not be doing with the land once we started the process of buying the land?
Mr. Chairman, Vice President Muscoplat may have some thoughts on this too, but my understanding is that we would continue with the uses we are now making of the land. I think there are certain tenants who are on the land that those leases would ultimately be phased out because I think they are incompatible with the natural uses of the land that's contemplated.
So is it fair to say the university will be able to continue to use the land as they have been using it currently, for whatever purposes they've been using it currently, even if the state buys the land?
Mr. Chairman, that would be correct, but the university would enter into negotiations with DNR immediately. So, for example, if the DNR thought that it was appropriate that there be no agricultural research plots within, say, 1,000 yards of one of the tributaries to the Vermilion River, that's the sort of thing that we would entertain because everyone is going into this deal with the understanding that the environmental protection and the public use of this property is going to take precedence.
And I guess just a final question on that. And there's no, I know that, I guess, there's some contemplated number in terms of how many years we're going to make the payment, but I guess there's no limit in terms of number of years in terms of what the university's rights to continue to use the land for the current purposes are, is there?
Mr. Chairman, no, there is not.
Okay. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back a little over an hour ago, I think, President Brunich, in your introductory comments, you made some comments about the comparison to the possible use of the Metrodome. There are a number of constituents in my area and certainly in my community who envisioned a painted maroon and gold top to the Metrodome and felt as though that was practical. You gave some numbers, but whether it's now or follow-up, I would really like a better business case comparison. I mean, it appears as though the annual flow, if you sort of double the state annual contribution, we're in the $18-19 million or so range. And you mentioned $7 million to operate the Metrodome. There were some other expenses for renovation. But, of course, at least in my naive view, the Metrodome also has some potential additional commercial uses above and beyond what an open-air stadium would have, too. So if the business case would have to sort of take those into account. If you could elaborate just a little more here, and if there's a more detailed business analysis, these are very persistent, and very many of them, by the way, are very active and very supportive alumni that feel fearless. So I'd like to be able to discuss them more completely with them.
Yep. President Brunich.
Yeah. Chair Knobloch, Representative Bradley, the $6 to $7 million of operating expense comes from the Metropolitan Sports Commission and is the actual dollars that they expend and can expect that would be needed to sustain that facility on the long term, and that's based, I think, on documented records dealing with utilities and other related costs. Secondly, this is a facility that was completed, I think, roughly in 1982, if I'm not mistaken.
Its systems are arguably close to 40 years old. The roof on the facility is in need of some serious work and perhaps replacement in the near term. The building operating systems, of a complex structure like that rarely last beyond 35 to 40 years. They're extraordinarily expensive to replace. I know that the Metropolitan Sports Commission, in envisioning some improvements to the Metrodome, developed a plan that was pretty close to $280 million, but that involved expanding the corridors and pushing the building out and doing some other things as well. But I don't have any doubt, to be honest with you, that we'd be looking at, I would argue, probably $5 to $10 million of capital costs annually for many, many years if you capitalize the expense of those basic systems that are going to start failing and failing at a fairly alarming rate over the next several years. But, I don't know that anyone has actually documented what it would take to replace the roof, what it'll take to replace all those building systems, but I'm just basing our estimate on trying to run complex buildings and operations at the University of Minnesota, like Williams Arena or Mariucci Arena. And I don't have any doubt that we're looking at, well, I'll be honest with you, if we were to inherit this thing, a real turkey. I mean, I just don't think you would sustain it. Now, the other thing I would argue, let's say the University of Minnesota is the sole tenant of the Metrodome, which some people have recommended. Think about this. Metrodome sits right next to the rail stop. It's right in the center of extraordinary downtown development. I can't imagine that people would consider that to be a good bargain for the state for us to play football there a few times a year, with the underlying value of that land essentially going to waste for other purposes. So I think there are just a lot of complex reasons why the business case is very, very compelling to move this stadium back to the campus where I think it belongs. But I think the case for the university's academic and community mission is even more powerful and more persuasive, and particularly in light of the kind of private fundraising strategy we've developed with this proposal.
Representative Bradley.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Prunix, and members. I don't want to expand too much the discussion here, but I've kind of tracked the numbers so far, and the numbers don't work. It's just pure numbers. I can understand maybe there's some other value judgments are involved here. So if I could request, I have a feeling, maybe it isn't all detail, but that somebody's done a little bit more analysis than we've been able to in this brief discussion. So if someone could follow up with me and give me some numbers, I'm going to meet with some of those people this coming Saturday, and I'd like to have some better analysis and numbers.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, 2 years ago on the Tax Committee, Bill Lester from the Sports Facilities Commission testified that it would take $7 million per year in 2004 dollars to operate the Metrodome. And outside of the Twins, the Vikings, and Gophers, there are very few real revenue-generating activities here. Yeah, there's the occasional tractor pull and the occasional concert, but it will not come anywhere near the dollars necessary in order to keep the facility open. It doesn't even hit a seven-figure sum. So, the public policy question is, given what the embedded operating costs are in the Metrodome, are you better off building a new open-air stadium on campus and allowing the Metrodome to go to a better use? But I do recall, Representative Bradley, the $7 million number that was used by Mr. Lester.
That's what we're using, too.
Well,
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, my last comment, though, even a new stadium, as it ages, is going to require some maintenance work. I mean, so that's kind of what I'm at here, is just a fair balance sheet comparison, really, and I'm not there yet.
Okay, I've got Representative Sikora next. Representative Sikora.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Between you and Representative Bradley, you ask my questions.
Representative Dempsey.
I'll pass, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Prinky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Abrams, I'm a little curious when at the outset of the hearing today you said on the transfer of the property, you compared it to a contract for deed. My understanding of contract for deed is when you make the payments, you get to live there. We don't, state of Minnesota has an extremely limited use, according to the legislation, and the uses are only those uses which essentially the University of Minnesota allows to occur on the site. Am I somehow misreading this? Dr. Brunix, you seem to say no.
Yes,
that's
you
not
are.
The case.
President Brunix,
take it.
Yeah, Chair Knobloch, Representative Krinke. The plan here is for the DNR and the university to develop a expanded public use plan. What the university is retaining is rights to continue research, related to the natural environment, related to water quality, related to wildlife habitat, those things that are not intrusive in the property. Now, there is some agricultural research land and plots in that area where we have decades of longitudinal data that I think some people would like to protect. But that will be, in my judgment, highly compatible with the public use, the extensive public use of this property. So the plan here is to together radically and substantially increase public use of the property and to do so over this 25-year period. It is already used by the public very extensively. There's a riding trail, there are hiking trails, there are lots of areas that are already used extensively, but not to the extent that I think we envision as part of a regional park system. And I wouldn't leave out the fact that there are green zone areas adjacent to the south. There's a Dakota County plan to purchase land directly to the east to create a much greater park-like and nature preserve area.
Representative Frankie.
Well, Mr. Chairman, President Brunix, Representative Abrams, some people, when this concept was unveiled, I think including the governor, called this a win-win. Looking at this legislation, I would view it as a lose-lose-lose. I'm not sure where the state and the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota come out ahead. Number one, as I discussed with President Brunix just yesterday, the taxpayers paid for this land to start with through their federal tax dollars when the property was taken through eminent domain. Now the taxpayers get to pay for it again, and it is the seems to be that the university is somehow saying that this is land that the state wants. I've never seen any legislation in the 15 years that I've been here forwarding that this land was something that the state wanted. I've never seen any legislation. Again, I obviously may be incorrect, but that this was somehow property that the state of Minnesota wanted for some particular purpose. Certainly seen lots of land bills go through the process, seen several state park lands added to, other state parks designated, lots of other CREP land and other land that has been acquired by the state of Minnesota. Never saw this one on the list. And then in addition to being generous with purchasing the land and not necessarily having control over it for 30 years, then you say, well, you're not going to make the payments according to the contracts that you signed for the Metrodome. So where is the win-win in this proposal?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Akers.
Mr. Chairman, I view the original Gopher Stadium proposal as a win-win. It would return football to the campus of the University of Minnesota for roughly the cost of operating an obsolete facility that is off campus. It would bring back pride. I wish I had Glenn Mason here to go through it, but if Representative Krinke, if Carl Pohlad tomorrow said he would be willing to spend 60% of the cost for a twin stadium, or Ziggy Wolf said that he would spend 60% of the construction cost of a Viking stadium, I think that the conversation would go a whole lot better, quite frankly. So, as the only Division I football program in the state, and as our flagship state research university, I view the original proposal as a win-win. I know that you didn't, Representative Krenke, and I certainly respect that. What is the value added? Because I haven't made the assertion, nor has President Brunings, nor has anybody involved in this, made the assertion that the value added of the land is worth, and it is worth $124 million in present dollars, or $9.4 million a year for, I believe, 25 years, which would defeat the bonds. What the argument is that it was already a win-win, and yes, there are some additional state dollars involved, but for the additional state dollars, you are going to have increased access and use of some prime, pristine property, by and large, in Dakota County, in order for more people to recreate and be able to keep it from other uses. So, if you viewed the previous proposal as a win-win proposal, I view this as more of a win-win proposal. Now, you know, there's somebody else in the audience who can give a little bit more, put a little bit more bone on, or meat on the bone. But that's how I personally view it, Representative Krenke. And I know that we disagreed about the original proposal, and there's no surprise that we disagree on the enhanced proposal.
You know, I guess the question of the land, President Brunix, Representative Abrams, I guess I'm still trying to understand this. The state is buying this land underneath the terms of the agreement that's proposed here, assuming nothing's changed. Can the state ever sell any of the land?
Mr. Chairman, that would be subject to the basically the covenant that would be running with the land for the uses of the University of Minnesota is the way I would read the bill.
I see a couple of gentlemen in the back who are shaking their heads. Mr. Larson, could you come forward? Mr. Larson, welcome back to the committee.
Okay, Chair Knobloch, I'm delighted to keep coming back. There's nothing in the legislation that would prevent the state from selling the land if it owned it. However, the idea of the legislation and the idea of an agreement or covenants that are entered is that the protection for the land would be permanent. And so if the state did sell the land, it would be selling it to a buyer who would agree to manage and maintain the land subject to those covenants. In other words, keeping it available for open space and recreational uses.
Mr. Larson, would the university not have a option to prevent the state from selling any of the land if it chose, because the university is still permitted certain university uses that run with this agreement?
Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't characterize it as an option. No, I mean, it's the university would have a continued right to use the land for certain purposes, and any purchaser from the state of Minnesota would take it subject to those university rights. But we would not have an option to prevent the state from transferring the land. And in fact, the legislation contemplates that the state might decide not to acquire any of the land, in which case the covenants and agreements would continue in perpetuity without state ownership, or that the university and the state could agree to convey the land to some other unit of government. So, for example, the legislation contemplates that Dakota County, which has got a park planned for immediately adjacent to it, could become the owner of all or part of that land should the state of Minnesota and the University of Minnesota agree that that would be appropriate.
So I guess, Mr. Larson, the state could sell the land if it found a buyer who was willing to go along with the continued university use of the land.
That's correct. That's correct.
Representative Krenke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just two questions. One financial. What is the current lease payment made by the university to the Metropolitan Sports Facilities Commission on an annual basis?
President Brunix.
Chair Knobloch, Representative Krenke, we have no lease payment to the Metrodome at the present time. We also have very little revenue options in the Metrodome at the present time. There is no parking revenue. We get something like 30% of the concession revenue at the present time. We have no ability to market the boxes as a part of the game day activity, and so
the options for revenue at the Metrodome place the university's football program under the best of circumstances at the bottom of the Big Ten, which I see to be a serious problem for the future. But we don't pay a lease payment, but we also don't derive very much economic benefit for playing there as well.
So,
Representative Frankie,
Mr. Chairman, essentially you've played at the Metrodome for free for the last 25 years?
Chair Nabrock, Representative Krinke, you know the old expression about a free lunch. I can tell you that if you're at the bottom of the Big Ten in revenues because you can't market your facility and you can't derive very much benefit from it, I don't think it's exactly been a free good to the University of Minnesota. I have Ms. Liz Ewell, who is the Chief Financial Officer for Intercollegiate Athletics, and I think she could give you a much more detailed response.
Welcome to the committee. Could you please state your name for the record and give us your testimony?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Liz Ewell. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for Gopher Athletics. Mr. Chairman, Representative Prinke, we pay game day expenses that total about $90,000 for each event we have, each football event we have at the Dome, and that is made up by a number of costs. We pay for the cleaning of the Dome. We pay for air conditioning. We pay for security and some other incidental costs that add up to about $90,000 per event that we have at the Metrodome, and some of that obviously goes to the Metropolitan Sports Facilities Commission for the cost of air conditioning and cleaning.
Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Where's the university going to play baseball?
President Brunix?
Chair Knobloch, Representative Krinke, is there any chance to take the Fifth Amendment before the committee?
You're not under subpoena, President Brunix.
Just kidding. This is a very interesting topic now at the University of Minnesota. At the present time, we play, courtesy of the Twins, some preseason games at the Metrodome. I'm assuming if the Twins get a stadium, we may play some preseason games if it's a domed facility and can be operated in the cold winter months. We have the issue of where we're going to ultimately play baseball on the table right now. We've had a major study done about whether it makes sense to locate and site a remodeled stadium on campus. We think that has some real advantages, particularly in getting probably a couple of thousand of our students involved in intramural sports, but we haven't come to any conclusion as to how we're going to solve this problem long term. Seaford Field, I'll tell you, is absolutely obsolete in terms of the core facilities. The field is adequate, but the core facilities are not. So we have this issue under review, and we're going to have to solve this problem either in partnership with one or more of the professional teams in our community or by raising some money and building some improvements on campus.
Maybe they got some more land they want to sell. Mr. Chairman,
Representative Krinke.
One more. President Brunix, you're familiar with the creating a lasting legacy for Umore Park, advancing the University of Minnesota's academic mission. It's an executive committee report to President Brunix dated September 2005. Are you familiar with this report, read this report?
Chair Knobloch, Representative Krinke, I commissioned it, and so I'm quite familiar with it.
Then can you tell me, President Brunix, what's changed since September 2005 to April 2006? Because in this report, the opening statement in the report is, any financial gain the University of Minnesota might receive over time for the Umore Park should be reinvested into a perpetual endowment that can be used to fund the academic priorities that are uniquely linked to the university's mission to provide world-class research, education, and outreach.
President Brunix?
Chair Knobloch, Representative Krinke, nothing has changed since then. That's still the very, very highest value. I would point out to you that based on a half a dozen studies, we have always viewed this part of the property, or at least a portion of this part of the property, as being highly sensitive environmentally. and in need of protection. Not 2,840 acres, I would argue, but a substantial amount of this property. It was never envisioned that we would sell the interior of this property without protecting its environmental qualities and nature. So I would argue, though, that a football stadium at the University of Minnesota campus that allows us to convene literally tens of thousands of people is very much related to the academic mission of the University of Minnesota. I would invite your inspection of what happens at Ohio State, University of Michigan, Michigan State University on game day. There are academic programs for kids and for families and for adults. We envision a very, very strong academic emphasis in relationship to how we operate intercollegiate athletics. And I would also argue that a good deal of the benefits will also accrue to the university marching band. I think you would agree that those students are very much a part of the academic life of the University of Minnesota and make a phenomenal contribution to our state. There will be academic meetings in the rooms that are a part of the stadium. There can be academic convocations and graduations in the stadium. So I would argue, even if you wanted to push it in the other direction, that this university, by having a stadium on campus, will put it to very good academic use and make it a central part of the academic core values and operations of the university.
Representative Cranky.
Well, I'm a little taken back by your response, Dr. Brunix, because, this statement is quite clear. It doesn't say to fund the academic priorities. It says into a perpetual endowment. Endowment, to me, I think is pretty clear. An endowment is a trust fund that helps, where the amount of money in the trust is not touched, but rather the interest is used to carry on the academic mission. Can you maybe correct me as to how you think a football stadium is an endowment?
President Brunix.
Chair Knobloch, Representative Krinke, I don't want to try to do that because I think I'll be in a deep end of the pool with no prospect of surviving the argument. But let me just say this. This was a report. This is a working committee that I commissioned to come up with a set of recommendations for the long-term future of Umore Park. These are recommendations. They were not adopted as policies of the Board of Regents. What the Regents did adopt as policy is the proposal that you have in front of you. And the Regents have yet to adopt long-term. They have adopted long-term principles and values to guide the use of the property and the long-term planning of the property. But those were recommendations, and I strongly support that recommendation that you articulated just a few moments ago. I think the property should be substantially used in that fashion. But when people approach us, this wasn't the university's idea to put this proposal on the table for the state legislature. We were quite happy with the 60-40 proposal. We thought it was sound. But when people approached us and gave us the opportunity to work with DNR and to work with the local community to create a phenomenal public good for future generations of people in Minnesota and beyond, we thought it was an idea that we ought to at least embrace or at least consider, and we eventually decided to embrace it and take it through a pretty intensive examination by our Board of Regents that they adopted by a vote of 11-1.
Well, to this point, Representative Brunix, now, how much additional, I guess, profit would you say the university is going to accrue from having the stadium? I mean, as I understand it, this university is going to be able to make some additional money from having the stadium that they're not making from having the Metrodome lease that they have right now. Can you tell me how much that is?
Chair Knobloch, we estimate it's approximately $3 million a year. We estimate that every dime of that is going to be needed to fund the increased costs of intercollegiate football and other intercollegiate sports. We have 25 sports that we offer
through the University of Minnesota. I would argue that even with that incremental $3 million, the University of Minnesota is likely to be close to the bottom in the Big Ten in terms of available revenue to support its football and intercollegiate athletics program. But there's something in the neighborhood of $3 million that we anticipate would be incremental growth in revenue. And I would argue we desperately need it. Let me just point out one thing. You know that some time ago I was given a dowry when I was appointed as president of the University of Minnesota, something like a 15% budget cut, $185 million state reduction in a two-year period. At that time, I looked at the intercollegiate athletics budget, and there was some state support in that budget, and I trimmed that budget about 30% over a five-year period in an attempt to manage these budgetary reductions and balance the budget. So part of what needs to happen here, whether we get a stadium or not, is intercollegiate athletics is going to have to move with some haste and dispatch to make up for this difference, because it's not coming out of the academic height of the University of Minnesota.
I guess I was just wondering if you were going to say that the $3 million was actually the endowment. That was my question. Representative Carlson.
Chairman, I feel a bit in this room like I'm already in an open-air stadium about November.
Oh. Well, I meant $3 million as a compliment from the standpoint
the temperature of the room.
That's not
my question. I just thought I would comment, being that we have an open-air stadium question before us. We've turned the heat off in here.
All right. The fall is beautiful in Minnesota, Representative Carlson.
The question I have, I'm looking at the section of the bill that talks about the permitted uses and then the prohibited uses, and the state then is going to be the owner. How do you see conflict being resolved? Let's say that you've got a research initiative that's going to use some of that land, and DNR says, no, we don't feel that it really fits our purposes. Do you have some sort of a governance structure or process other than taking each other, if it were to elevate to that point, to court to see how this language would be enforced?
President Brunix.
Chair Knobloch, Representative Carlson, I don't think we can sit here and, predict all the issues that will come up, but the commitment here in legislation and by agreement is to build a cooperative relationship and work through these issues. You have two institutions that have very, very compatible missions here and a common dedicated purpose to really make this land useful, to protect it, preserve it, and to make it widely accessible. So I frankly don't anticipate that kind of a problem. We have many relationships with the Department of Natural Resources all over the state of Minnesota. We work cooperatively on the Forest Products or the Forest Resources Council, appointed by the governor in collaboration with the University of Minnesota and the forest products industry and DNR. So we have many experiences like this that I think give me a lot of optimism that this won't be an issue. I can't answer it in any more detail than that, but I do think there's a real spirit of cooperation in the legislation, intended in the legislation, and in our commitment.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm sure you're going into it with that feeling. I've been here long enough, however, to see where well-meaning people and two different state agencies will go at it head-to-head, and sometimes the legislature has to intervene and work out the differences. Mm-hmm. I was just, as I read this, I could see where there could be some disagreements between reasonable people on how that land use is going to take place. And so the question that I would have, or the comment, is that maybe it would be better to build something in up front in terms of how you resolve it. It doesn't necessarily have to be in the law.
Mm-hmm.
It could be in part of the agreement that you enter into as to how you're going to resolve land use problems if they should arise.
Right. Or at least that the process would create that dispute, any kind of anticipated dispute resolution.
Process up front, that before you get to that point where you have, Mr. Chairman, a a disagreement. Both sides are dug in on whatever the issue might be.
Well, President Brooks, I've got a few other questions. I guess first going back to this issue of buying the land, if I go to page 4, subdivision 2, line 9 forward, in fact, particularly line 12, is it fair to say that the only people we can sell this land to, if we ever chose to sell it, and if we got the university's approval, would be another public entity? And then maybe there's a question.
Chair Knobloch, you mean that in terms of the state's ability to sell the land?
Right. The state is buying the land. Yeah. Can we sell it to any private entity?
Well, I think Mr. Larson would be better and able to answer this, but I would assume you could sell it to private entities as long as they lived up to the requirements of the conditions of this statute. For example, a nonprofit like the Nature Conservancy would be a possibility, or any number of other entities that might be willing to operate it on that basis. But, you know, Ken, do you want to add it?
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chairman, there's not any limitation on who the transferee might be. We did specifically reference another local unit of government just as we look at the lay of the land right now and who might have an interest, just based on what we know today, in acquiring ownership of some piece of that land, Dakota County and its parks program came to mind. But there is nothing in the statute that limits who the potential buyer of the property could be. However, as has been stated here, the buyer would take it subject to whatever agreements existed between the university and the DNR, or whatever restrictive covenants the university had already placed on the land itself.
So, Mr. Larson, when I look at page 4, line 12, and I see the words, upon agreement of the university and the state, all or part of the university land may be transferred to another governmental unit of the state, you don't see that as excluding the state from selling it to a private entity?
No, I do not.
Okay. And subject to, of course, the university's approval and university's continuing rights. I guess let me ask, going to page 3, the $9.4 million a year payment. I know that the estimated principal amount is $124 million, but is there anything in this bill that limits how long we would be spending or how long we would be paying the $9.4 million? If the university wanted to get a 50-year bond, and there are longer bonds that public entities are starting to issue nowadays, I mean, might we be paying this for 50 years rather than, say, 20 years? Mr. Fitzenreiter?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the numbers were calculated based on a 25-year bond sale at 5.5%. That's why there is language in there that, by chance, the interest rate's only 5 at the time the university sells that debt. It won't be 9.4, it'll be less. But you are correct, Mr. Chairman, that there's nothing in here, and I would not have a problem limiting it to 25 years.
Okay. Yeah, I think that would be something that I'd be interested in seeing.
Mr. Chairman, not a problem.
Okay. All right. And I guess, Representative Abrams, I'm looking at, I guess if I go to page 4, line 21 forward, where it talks about the quitclaim deed, maybe that's in an old one, I'm not sure. Is that still in there, that language, or did we remove that?
Mr. Chairman, that language was removed in the Capital Investment Committee, and I know that the General Counsel's Office of the University has been in consultations with the Attorney General's Office and DNR attorneys regarding what, if any, language would be appropriate and I don't think that they've reached resolution yet. So, right, they have. But you know, I shared the concern that other members of the Capital Investment Committee had about the language as originally drafted.
Okay. So I guess, you know, when I look at this bill compared to the previous bill, I guess the net of it is that we as a state, if we would compare the old proposal with this proposal, putting myself in the state's shoes, would say, you know, it's worth $2 million a year for us to get the bundle of rights that is coming from the transfer of the land. We are not able to buy the land in sort of a normal sense other than transfer the title, because the university's got a lot more restrictions on the land than any land you would have if you just bought it, you know, in the private sector as a developer or something like that. But I guess the proposal is that the bundle of rights we're getting is worth $2 million a year for, I guess, 25 years.
Yeah.
Okay. Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and sorry I was late. We were doing the capital investment, and for those of you that want to know, it did pass unanimously just a couple minutes.
What's wrong with the bill?
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Abrams, so the difference between your original bill had payments that were 7.4, and now the payments would be 9.4. If we back it down to present day values, around $25 million.
Not even that.
Okay, somewhere less than $25 million. And if I understand the difference between the two bills, in the first one, we took what was a good thing. We were going to help fund a Gopher Stadium in the neighborhood of around 40%. And the state would get on-campus football, which many of us support. Under the new proposal, we still get those benefits. In addition to, if I understand right, the Board of Regents very favorably could decide to take the additional somewhere in the neighborhood of $25 million, reduce the student fee from $50 a semester to $25 a semester, which would save the students, I believe, $25 million. So basically the $25 million the state's paying, students would not have to pay. And if I understand students right, they maybe don't have all the money in the world. But then another benefit is that the state comes to possess this land of 2,840 acres, additional 320 acres of buffer for the public to use under the management of the DNR. I mean, this is like a triple win to me. I just really think it's a win-win-win, I think is the right way to put it. And I just want to thank you for bringing the bill forward, and glad you're still here testifying so I can give my 2 cents worth.
Thank you. Well, I think we're wrapping it up pretty quickly, but I guess going back to this whole, you know, concept of the $2 million and the use we're getting, you know, President Brunick said, this is, I haven't been out down on this land, but it's apparently very beautiful land. There's the trout stream we've heard about and all these other wonderful things. It is public land. Have people ever come to the university and said, we'd like to make some arrangement to have the public use the land more? I mean, would the university have charged them $2 million a year if the state wanted to provide more access to the public for this land?
Chair
Knobloch, it's easy to answer this question. The university provides pretty extensive access now. People pay a modest fee, for example, to use the trail system. I'm planning to ride a horse on this trail sometime in May with a group of people who want to visit the property. And so it's used quite extensively. In fact, I saw a couple of members of the legislature who walk regularly in that area and do bird watching. So the point, I think, is that it's not developed for broad-scale public use and education in quite the way that DNR develops open space and public parks. And to me, as I talk to the K-12 educators, we've met with the superintendents in that area, science teachers, many others, I think if we do this right, this will vastly expand the reach of this property in K-12 education, in serving the general public. But would the university provide public access? The answer is decidedly yes. We do so now. If we were to develop a different plan for this property,
the university might choose, when it builds its master plan for the property, choose to perhaps put buildings on part of this property, the part that is not is environmentally sensitive, but as Representative McNamara referred to, is now a strong buffer that surrounds the property and protect that is the environmentally sensitive area and protects it. So, you know, I could envision, absent this agreement, that some portion of this could be developed for commercial purposes. Some portion would always be dedicated to the protection of the Vermilion watershed, the endangered species, and the hills that are quite sensitive to erosion in that particular area, without the benefit of ground cover and the trees that are there at the present time. So, I think, there's not any way to answer this, but we have been generous in opening the land to the public now. In fact, have gone to the trouble of building some of the trail systems that people now use, and we would want to keep doing that. But I think there's so much more that could be done with respect to science education for young people, building outdoor kiosks, you know, the kind you see in the Hennepin Park system that I used to use quite often. So I think there are real benefits here. And the continuing university benefits and uses, as I point out, are very much compatible with what DNR would want to see happening in that property long term. Except for the agricultural plots, the way in which this land would be used by university people, students and faculty, would be relatively unobtrusive, I think, and very, very much compatible with its public use.
Are there any other questions from members? Well, seeing none, President Brunitz, Representative Abrams, Mr. Fitzenreiter, Mr. Larson, others, thank you very much for availing yourself of this chance for us to ask some questions and learn more about this important issue. Members, this room, 8:15 a.m. tomorrow, will be taking up this bill along with the rest of the agenda that we talked about. And I'd like to ask Republican members to come up to room 454 at the conclusion of this meeting so we can talk about some of the other agenda items. With that, members, we are adjourned.